Okay, the House Committee on Education will come to order. It is Wednesday, January 15th. If you have a cell phone on, please turn it off. That way everybody on the internet can hear. We have a little bit of a disjointed meeting today because what we want to do is accommodate the members that want to speak on their bills. And different members can come at different times, and those times are not necessarily sequential in the time and space continuum.
Madam Chair, three of us are used to that because that's what we did this morning in higher ed.
Yes, we do.
I'm glad you came to practice. So we may be stopping and starting a little bit. There might be a couple brief breaks. The last presentation that I know of is Representative Buckley is coming at 3:45.
But it's Representative Buckley?
Yeah, that's okay.
Representative Buckley's coming at 3:45, and that will be the last thing on our agenda, unless you all talk a lot.
He was already bothering us this morning.
Yeah.
I thought you guys wanted to be done at 4.
I would agree.
Rep. Buckley usually does have a
I agree. Let's go.
All right. Okay, we're in a committee hearing now.
Oh.
Great. All right. We are going to go out of order on the agenda because I think it would be a good idea to talk about what our committee measures are before we vote to introduce them. Some of you have mentioned before that you like to know what you're voting on, and I like to try to accommodate.
She's very helpful.
All right. So, is David here? Yes. Will you talk about the Providence piece? Great. So I'm going to open up an informational hearing on LC 44. Regarding the Providence Child Center, is there anybody else here that would like to talk about the Providence Child Center bill? Come on up, Dave. Oh, there's Cindy. I didn't see Cindy back there.
Okay, I did.
And all of these measures are up on OLIS? Yes? Great.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee, David Williams with Portland Public Schools. You may remember last session we had an issue arise during the session dealing with a program that we provide educational services for kids that are at the Providence Child Center in Portland. This is a pediatric skilled nursing facility that's sort of one of its kind on the West Coast and houses kids from around the state as well as from out of the state. There's some children from whose parents reside in Washington, Alaska, and California at the facility. About 58 kids in the facility. And we have been historically providing services to all these kids as if they were residents of PPS. Upon determining that they are not all residents, we then sought about finding a way to resolve this and make sure appropriate parties are financially responsible while still providing continuity of services to the kids. So we had a stopgap measure last session, working in conjunction during the interim with the department, the folks from the Providence Child Center, and Representative Gelser. We have LC 44 before you, which in a nutshell would take the students that are at the Providence Child Center, would essentially say that they are residents of the state. They are the state's children, and then the state, via the Department of Ed, would be responsible for contracting with the district in which the facility is located, which is Portland Public Schools, to deliver educational services to the kids. And then we'll be paying for this by pulling the money out of the state school fund, but no individual district could claim these students for either their base ADM or their special ed ADM or high-cost disabilities account. So it's a way to make sure that nobody sort of claiming a kid that they're not serving and then making sure these kids get served in the best possible manner via this model.
And David, could you just briefly describe, since they can't bill for high-cost disability, what impact that has on all of the districts in the state?
Right. Excellent. Thank you, Representative Gelser. As you know, the way some students get services for special education, you get a single weight for the individual kid. You get a double weighting for kids on IEPs. And that, let's just ballpark, that's about $15,000 for those kids. Then when the cost of delivering services to a high-cost disability student gets above $30,000, the district can submit for reimbursement to the state high-cost disabilities account. That currently reimburses about 50 cents on the dollar because there's a fixed dollar amount in that pot. As we remove kids, as a lot of these kids are eligible for the reimbursement under that, pulling kids out of that pot will thus obviously increase the percentage reimbursement for all the remaining districts that do get reimbursement of the high-cost disability account. I don't think we have the number on exactly, you know, if that'll go from 50 cents on the dollar to 60 cents or what, but it obviously would increase that reimbursement for all the rest of the remaining kids who do get services from that fund.
Cindy, did you have anything to add?
Department of Education. The only other thing I'd add to what David said is the other component of the bill is a direction to us and DHS to work with other states, namely Washington, around the kids who, you know, kind of come down from there. Most of those kids live in Vancouver, and so that's something that we would be engaging in the next year or so. And then there's a report back under it as well. And we've already started making contacts with Washington, so we don't see that as an issue. But no, we're very happy that all of the parties came together in a very collaborative way and discussed this particular population of children and that they'll continue receiving an education.
Thank you. And just thanks to both of you and everybody that was on this work group. It really was a very collaborative work group. And I think services for kids are going to be a little bit better. One of the things that we learned in the process was that kids that go for a shorter stay, they might be there for just a couple of months rather than living there long term. There really hasn't been a mechanism to get them hooked up with education services, which means they've been missing a lot every year. And as a result of these discussions, kids will be getting, I think kids are going to be getting more services. It's going to be more affordable for everybody to do it. It's going to make more sense and kind of a win-win-win all around. And just many thanks to Portland Public Schools and the department and DHS and Providence for really working hard together in something that started out with a little bit of a conflict, but now it's a great thing.
No, and thank you to Representative Gelser for pulling us all together. Absolutely. It was a good work product.
Are there any questions? Representative Spear.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to be ultra clear here, because one of the conversations that usually comes out of policy like this is, and I understand the population we're serving here, is either an ESD or a school district saying, my responsibility, I couldn't do this, it's that person's responsibility. Are we being very clear that the parents have one place to go, and that's to ODE if they have a concern? Or I want to make sure, because parents have a lot going on, these parents have a whole lot going on, I don't want them getting the runaround, well, here's the home district and all that. I want one very easily identified source for them to go to.
Chair Gelser, Representative Springer, I share your belief, if you will. But there's also, I think, a reality. And one of the things that came up, I think, in our work group is that with the parents, especially a lot of the parents, their primary point of contact for the kids is Providence. So a lot of the parents, that's who they go to first, you know, for everything,
that's,
you know.
Fair.
And so, you know, and some of the parents go to PPS and others come, you know. And so one of the things that we had done, gosh, I think this was back even in the 2013 session when this issue started to first boil up, is there was some community meetings with parents. And I think Representative Gelser went to one of those where some parents started to learn, oh, I don't just have to go to Providence. Oh, there's PPS, and they were there. Oh, there's the Department of Ed. And so that was one of the positive things that was coming out of this is I think the parents are better informed about their options and where they can go. And one of the things that's kind of interesting about this particular population is that unlike some of the other programs that ODE operates, that this population, a lot of these kids, they don't come and go. They stay for very long periods of time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so once a certain group of parents kind of understands, you know, what's going on, I mean, that's going to continue for years and years and years, you know, if you understand what I'm saying. But as far as, you know, with our other contracts, when there are complaints on those programs, generally they go to the administration of, you know, in this case would be PPS, but they can also come to us. So they would actually have a couple of places that they could come. But in that, very clearly in the bill, it says the Department of Education is responsible for the education of these children, so the buck stops here, or with Mr. Saxton, as the case might be.
Brief follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If there's a way, this is just my personal ask, if there's a way to make sure these parents understand that, because I don't want them getting the runaround with different districts, and I realize Providence, that's a totally different entity that we're talking about, but they can go to ODE and say, this is my educational problem, and I need your help to solve it.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Representative Gelser, Representative Springer, I think just to add to that, I think actually this does clarify responsibility to a great degree. I think you saw a point in time last session where there was some of that, well, some of these kids are my responsibility, some are Reynolds, some are Vancouver School District, and this really makes it clear the responsibility is in one spot. And I think that will help the folks at Providence as well, the administrators. We know who the responsible party is. We know our contacted department, so we really will be able to work.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none? Great. Is there anybody that I missed? All right. So we'll close that informational hearing and then open up an informational meeting on LC 145 regarding correction school funding, House Bill 2097. Are we, Cindy, are you coming back for that or is that Jan? Because I don't see Jan.
It's not supposed to be Cindy.
Away. And if there's anybody from OIA here or working on the group, if you want to come up too, that's fine. Welcome back, Cindy Hunt. We're probably going to call you up for the next one too. Cindy Hunt, Department of Education. I apologize a little bit for that. My counterpart had to step aside and do some educating of some interns in the Capitol. So LC 145 comes to you, and it involves two of the programs of the Oregon Department of Education, the Youth Corrections Education Program and the Juvenile Detention Education Program. By way of differences between those two programs, the Youth Corrections Program, these are children who are in correctional institutions such as McLaren or Hillcrest. Juvenile detention education programs are kids who are in detention or in jail, but it's two separate programs that we do operate. These programs for the youth corrections education program, those kids are typically have an average stay of about 83 days, and last year there were about 1,231 youths in that program. In the juvenile detention facility program, those kids typically have an 8.2-day average stay. So that's a difference between the two, as you would expect. And there's about 3,207 youth in that program. So one of the issues that's come up periodically with these programs is kind of the instability of funding. Because when we look at our school districts for a very long time, I think it's in the 90s. The school districts have the concept of extended ADMW. So you take how many ADM or numbers of students you have this year compared to last year, and you get the higher. And the reason for that is so then you can predict your budget, and your budget kind of levels off. That concept was never applied to these two programs. So we've had some swings in funding over the years, and especially the smaller programs, that tends to affect them to a greater extent, because if you have a larger swing, you have less ability to even out your program. And so in the interim, we had started speaking to, I know, Chair Gelser, which we want to thank today for moving forward with this concept. And so one of the easy fixes to this is to simply apply the extended ADMW concept to these two programs. And with that, we would urge your support of the bill. And just to clarify, this does not change the state school fund formula?
No, it is not.
Does not change the amount that you get per kid?
No, it does not.
My name is Christine Kirk, and I am with the Oregon Youth Authority. And similar to the last presentation, my being here simply recognizes the partnership that we have in educating our youth between ODE and the contract, the service districts, as well as the Youth Authority, where the youth are housed. And we are also in support of this because of the added stability that it provides to our kids during the school year at a very important time for them to get an education in a captive place. And for us to be able to achieve the positive outcomes that we are able to achieve without these mid-year changes in staffing levels that then require some drastic changes at times that impact the kids during the school year. So we appreciate your consideration of this and ODE's efforts to articulate on everyone's behalf the impact. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions or comments from the committee? Is everybody feeling okay?
I asked a question. Chris, too.
You did.
I feel fine.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. All right. Last one, we're going to open up an information hearing on... Hey, Cindy, I wouldn't go too far. open up an information hearing on LC 186 regarding stability of student enrollment. Morgan.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Oregon School Boards Association. And I certainly feel for Cindy. I understand that, getting called back up.
And if you don't want to come back up, you don't have to.
But, Madam Chair and members of the committee, this bill, if you remember in the 2013 session, you passed House Bill 2747, which made changes to how districts implement inter-district transfers of students. And during the period since you've adjourned, both OSBA and COSA have received a lot of feedback from the folks in schools and got a lot of questions from school board members, administrators, and heard some questions from students and families. And the good news is 2747 has not fully gone into effect yet, so we have some recommended technical changes that we think will accomplish three things. So we have three goals with LC 186. The first goal is to preserve transfer choices and options for students. The second is allow districts to provide continuity in enrollment for students who currently have transfers. And the third thing is the language in the bill will give our boards and our administrators the ability to implement House Bill 2747 as it was intended by the legislature. So I'll briefly talk about the three items that the bill addresses and certainly would be willing to answer any questions. The first item that the bill does is it requires districts to address what I would call mobility or mid-year moves if requested by the student. So, for example, I'll give you one example. Let's say it's your senior year in high school and your mom gets transferred. You live in Portland and your mom gets transferred to a job in Albany, but it's the middle of the school year. You've been going to that high school for 3.5 years. You've been in that district your whole career, and you'd like to finish and graduate with the kids that are your friends and that you've gone to school with. This bill would actually require, if the student requested it, Albany and Portland to allow that student to finish the school year in Portland. So we think that's a very important issue, particularly for some members on this committee. We heard a lot from the superintendents and boards in East Multnomah County, where there's a lot of mobility of students and, you know, housing issues, job issues, and these families are very mobile. So we want to ensure that there's stability for those students to at least be able to finish out that school year, and then going forward they would have the ability to seek transfers or open enrollment or figure out their situation. But this would guarantee that they could complete that school year if they wanted to. The second issue is it gives districts the ability, essentially, I'll just use the term grandfather, but students who are on inter-district transfers during this current school year, the 2013-14 school year, it gives the school districts that are educating those students essentially the tools to grandfather or guarantee that those students can continue their transfers going forward if they wish to. If the district wants to keep allowing students to transfer in, they can essentially give preference or grandfather those students that have transfers this year so they can continue their education. And one of the things we heard from some folks is there are students in the state who have had transfers for several years, where maybe they've been in a district for 5 or 6 years, or they may never have actually gone to school in the district they live in. They're going to a neighboring district on a transfer. This would allow continuity for those students as well. And the third issue that I think this is going to the issue of giving administrators and boards the tools to make sure 2747 is implemented properly. Going forward, when students request transfer, so if I live in Albany and I want to go to Corvallis, and Albany's willing to let me go, and Corvallis is willing to take me, now the receiving district, Corvallis, gets to decide the length of that transfer. So there's no year-to-year negotiation. It's less stressful for the students and their family. They don't have to think about having to try to renew that every year. It gives the receiving district the ability to say, you can stay for 3 years, or you can stay through the highest grade level at the school you're going to attend, or you can stay till you graduate. And so we think that is better for students, and it gives clarity to the boards and administrators on how to negotiate those transfers. So those are the changes in the bill. I certainly would be happy to answer any questions. We have shopped this draft extensively with people in the field, superintendents, administrators, etc. We have positive enthusiasm for the changes, universal support for the changes. We've asked people to take a really close look, make sure we got the language right, and we hope we can move forward with this draft at this point. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks. Any questions? Representative Reardon.
Thank you. First of all, thank you for your work. I attended a meeting last week, I believe it was, with East Multnomah County superintendents, and they were talking about this a little bit and talking about really if a student's in Reynolds or Centennial, they might move across the street and not even know that they've changed school districts. So just from that aspect, this is really helpful, so appreciate that. And then I believe that I heard him say there formerly there were like half a dozen different ways that kids could, processes that students could go through to transfer from one district to another, and that this would streamline it so there's one simpler.
I think that, so Chair Gelser and Representative Reardon, the first part of your is right. This is about addressing mobility, and particularly we heard about that in East Multnomah County, and I think the folks out there are satisfied that this will ensure that. The second issue you bring up is a larger issue that I think is more of a 2015 conversation.
Okay.
Today we're specifically talking about inter-district transfers, but there are six pathways for students to attend school in a district they don't live in, and I think that's something we may be bringing back. There's a COSA work group that Cindy Hunt and I are part of, looking at potentially streamlining that in 2015, making it easier to understand for students and family and easier to understand for districts to implement. So that's a 2015 conversation, and I'd certainly be happy to come and talk to you about that at another time.
And I would, Representative, argue that the changes that we make in this, especially because we are kind of limiting the number of times that a student has to get permission to leave the district in which they live,
yeah,
this really pulls the inter-district transfer policy, makes it very, very, very similar to the open enrollment policy.
Yeah.
They're very, very close together, and I think that will make it a little bit easier to have the conversation,
yeah,
going forward. This,
okay. I just wanted to make sure I understood the scope of it. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I've got a question. Morgan, you had said that the district the district has the ability to determine how long that transfer is good for. And then in reading, if I'm reading in the right spot, page 6, lines 16 through 20, it talks about that has to be consistently applied to all students, as it would be. My question is there a point that could be changed midstream? So kids can come in and they can stay through 8th grade.
Excellent question, Representative Springer. So I think the first answer is, so the important thing is that the district where the student lives no longer has the ability to change that midstream. So essentially, let's go back to the example of the student going from Albany to Corvallis. Once Albany says they can go to Corvallis, Albany's out of the picture, and now Corvallis has control of that link, that time frame. And I don't believe once you couldn't change it midstream, because if let's say, for example, you said all our transfers are valid for 3 years, I don't believe the law allows you to go back and change it. No, we're going to change that to 2. And it's particularly important that you noted the language about essentially treating all kids the same. You couldn't go back and say for student A, you can keep coming for 3 years, but all of a sudden student B, no. You're 1 year, sorry, Charlie. So that is specifically prohibited by House Bill 2747, and this bill doesn't change that.
That's what I wanted to be clear.
That is the case. I think one other thing that we didn't talk about, one of the pieces of feedback, we were trying to better understand students in special education, how they were served. Under the current law, and tell me if I have this wrong, under the current law, the funding follows the student to the district in which they attend. So that Albany student in Corvallis, if they are a special education student, Corvallis is getting the twice weight for that student. What we still need to clarify is that the FAPE responsibility belongs to Corvallis and not Albany, and we talked about that with the department, and that is something that can be fixed by rule.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, after 2747 passed, that prompted us to go in and work on amending our rules and doing an FAQ and that kind of thing. And so one of the things in doing that, and also in doing some outreach to the field and so forth, one of the primary questions was this question of special ed responsibility, because if you remember from open enrollment and also charter schools, special ed responsibility shifts once the child shifts to that district that's where the child is attending. And people start asking that question, why doesn't it shift here? And so inter-district transfer predated those other types of transfer mechanisms. And so when our rule was first written, I think it was about 7 years ago, federally we couldn't shift it. And so it kind of predates what Oregon's done. And so as we were talking back and forth with Chair Gelser, yes, through rule, I believe we will be shifting that over. And making it, one of the goals that we have is to make all these transfer mechanisms a little more uniform from one to the next. And because we think that's just clearer for districts, it's clearer for parents, it's clearer for kids. It's easier to administer, frankly.
And kind of goes back to Representative Springer's question on the other issue.
Yeah.
Knowing who it is ultimately that's responsible. Are there other questions or comments? There are none. Thank you very much. All right. So we'll close that informational hearing. And that is the end of our three committee bills. So with that, I will open up a work session on the introduction of committee bills. Let's see. Which of these
right here.
Ah. Okay. So, what? Who would like to make the motion?
I'm in the queue.
You're in the queue. Okay, Representative Springer.
Chair Gelser, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 44 relating to students admitted to pediatric nursing facilities. LC 145 relating to distributions of state funds for the education of youths in confinement. LC 186 relating to continuity in the enrollment of resident students.
Non-resident students.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Big difference.
Representative Springer moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 44 relating to students admitted to pediatric nursing facilities. LC 145 relating to distributions of state funds for the education of youths in confinement. And LC 186 relating to the continuity in the enrollment of non-resident students. Is there any discussion? Gosh, you guys are hard today. Seeing none, is there any objection to the introduction of these measures? Seeing none, the measures are introduced as committee bills. All right. So this is what we have left to do today. We are going to hear presentations on potential member bills. Representative Fagan has one to do now. Does anybody else on this panel that's on this committee want to talk to the committee about their and Representative Burton? So we'll do Representative Fagan, Representative Reardon, and then we may have a brief break. We have Representative Comp and Representative Johnson and Representative Buckley. They're all coming. And I'm going to open up an informational hearing on presentations on potential member bills for 2014.
Madam Chair, Madam Vice Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. Is that all my time?
Your time's up.
Good afternoon. I want to just talk very quickly about a bill concept I'm working on for February. Just a little bit of history. Obviously, the recession that our state has gone through in our country, but in particular our state has gone through in the past 10 years, underfunding of schools, growth of class sizes, has exacerbated what we already knew existed in terms of an achievement gap between low-income students and students from low-income families and students who are not from low-income families. And in 2012, 94 of Oregon's lowest performing schools were in high poverty schools were identified by the Department of Ed as what they called focus and priority schools. And to these schools, the state gave grants in order to target these schools and to obviously try to raise their achievement. One of them was the early reading opportunity grants, and there were others. The next year, 2013, almost 20 schools, 19 in fact, were identified as what they called targeted Title I other schools. But essentially, low-income schools that are low-performing, except there was no grant that came along with that designation. We just recognize that these are low-income schools that are low-performing, but there was nothing that came along with that to actually solve the problem. And so this is a bill concept I'm working on that basically creates a grant that is targeted in the law, and there is an LC for it now, which is LC 249. Which in the law requires that the grant money be spent to, quote, increase instructional time available during a summer program. The initial amount that the fully funded grant would be $660,000. And what this would do would provide for all 19 of these schools a five-week, fully funded summer program for instructional time. It would provide the staff and including a summer meal program. And studies have shown that the summer gap is actually what contributes by far more than any other factor to the achievement gap. In fact, it actually makes up what they say is two-thirds of the reading gap that we see in ninth grade. In colloquial terms, that means, you know, summer starts. From some families, kids get to go to, you know, OMSI a lot. They get to read with their parents. They go to cool summer camps, and they kind of continue their learning. Low-income kids often don't have that opportunity, and so they actually they either tread water or they actually slide during the summer while their counterparts are actually growing. And so all of a sudden, school starts in September, and the low-income kids have actually fallen farther behind. And so targeting this investment to summer learning programs is something that we can do to actually, like I said, two-thirds of the problem is the summer gap, but that actually presents an opportunity, which means if we can do targeted programs, that means we can come up with two-thirds of the solution in one fell swoop. So that's the idea behind this bill. I've got the bill back if anybody wants to sign on. We certainly obviously have to wait as far as the funding conversation to move to a different committee, but I've already spoken with Representative Buckley and just let him know this would be one of my priorities for February, and I'm certainly willing to answer any questions.
Anybody have any questions for Representative Fagan?
Cool.
Seeing none? Great. Thank you very much. Good job.
Thank you.
Representative Braden. And for everybody that's in the room, the way that this process has been working here and at other committees, we're just having the members come and preview the bills rather than having all of the advocates and supporters come up. And it's the first time we've tried this way. Like, what did I do this summer? What bill did I have drafted?
Good afternoon. I'm Representative Jeff Reardon, District 48. It's always a pleasure to address this fine panel. So, Chair Gelser, thank you for having me, your committee members. This is a bill. It's LC 85. Has to do with career technical education. I want to tell you just a brief couple of examples of why I think it's what the problem is. And it has to do back when I was teaching shop classes. And I did something foolish at home and was injured and out of work for a month. And during that time, into my wood shop, that's the place with all the sharp tools, we had a totally unqualified PE teacher that had a very difficult time for about a month. The following year, our metal shop teacher took a different position late in the year. We went through a period of probably 3 or 4 months of rotating substitutes, anywhere from a few days to maybe a couple of weeks. Finally, second half semester, we got a totally unqualified but licensed teacher that filled out the rest of the year. That's not good for the substitutes. That's not good for the kids. It just doesn't work well. So why bring this up? Because I see that we're kind of on a collision course of we're trying to ramp up our career technical education programs. We've just invested another close to $10 million through the revitalization grant, so a wonderful move. My concern is who's going to teach these classes. So I gave you a couple of examples from my personal experience, but from talking to other folks, it's not an isolated case. We have not prepared teachers of career technical classes for decades in the state of Oregon. I don't honestly know when we stopped doing that, but at Oregon State, you used to be able to take industrial arts classes and other business classes, things like that, to prepare. They don't do that any longer. So my concept here is that we do need to learn more about this issue, and so simply a task force would have 17 members from industry, from the teachers' standards and practices, from the teachers' unions, and a broad array of industries, and including healthcare, building trades and so forth. I can read them if you wish, but basically take a look at this, try to figure out how can we attract well-qualified teachers that know these technical subjects well. How can we attract them? How can we prepare them if we do get them to come over to the teaching world? How do you prepare them? Do they really need to go to a four-year education, or can we do something, work on teaching techniques? I'm very concerned about compensation. If somebody's making $70,000, $75,000 a year to Ford Garage, are they going to want to go to work in a shop class with the eager learners for $40,000? So how do we deal with that? So these are some of the questions that I have. I think a task force is a good way to address that, learn more about the issue, and I would urge your support.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Representative Rudin or comments?
Just kidding.
Another excellent presentation. Well done. Well done. Thank
you. I'll have to go back along just in case somebody's eager to sign up.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you very much. All right. So, Representative Johnson's coming at 3. Representative Comp is coming at 3:15. Representative Buckley's coming at 3:45. So we're going to have a couple breaks. But before we have the break, in February, we're going to come into session like we tend to do. And we're going to have pretty full agendas, especially that first week as we work through House bills. We are going to have a number of bills in the committee, and we'll have some lengthy work to do on some of those bills to get them ready. We'll need to vote them out of the committee, moving them forward by, if you think we come in on Monday, a week from Wednesday. So we have 4 hearings. That means for the bills that are in our committee, if you're wanting to amend them, or you're hearing things here, you've got concerns, please be sure to talk to the sponsors and the stakeholders, because we're really going to need to know what those amendments are by that first Wednesday, day 3 of session, in order to get the amendment back written the right way and the fiscal back to Richard in time to be able to have the paperwork that we need to move the bills forward. So over-communication is really important in on such a short timeline. After that week, we actually have a pretty full agenda for the month of February in terms of information sessions and other work that's going on related to education. So don't assume that we're going to stop meeting after that. First Wednesday, plan to be here Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 1 to 3 throughout the month of February. We've got some really good things planned. If you have, there's still a couple little slots left, but not many. If you have things you think we should be hearing or talking about, or visitors that we should have to the committee, please let me know as soon as possible so we can work those into the work plan. But otherwise, please don't schedule other meetings during House Ed for the month of February. Any questions?
Why were you looking at me?
I don't, because you've been so quiet. You
guilty.
No questions?
She's doing them.
I know.
Great. Okay, so with that, let's stand at recess. And are we at recess or are we at ease? We will stand at ease until 3 o'clock.
This is easier.
There's no swings and slides.
back. All right, welcome back. Representative Johnson, we are still in presentations about member bills.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the call up there. I was engaged in a conversation with a lobbyist, and you know how that goes, so pretty soon the day's gone. Thank you, members of the committee, Chair Gelser, for hearing me. I'm Mark Johnson, State Representative for House District 52, and I'm going to bring to you LC 98, I guess it is. This bill is one that we had last session. It involves Oregon School Boards Association and the Oregon Education Investment Board, and it simply is another small little change there, but we continue to believe that the OEIB and the work that they do would benefit from the presence of an OSBA member on that board. As some of you may be aware, I am a school board member, continue to serve at a locally elected school board, and it's a very valuable, it's been very valuable to have that experience as someone who at the local level can see how some of the policies that we all work with here, we pass here at this level, how they are actually implemented at the grassroots or at the ground level. And obviously we know that sometimes there can be a disconnect between Salem and Hood River or Hillsboro or Kaiser or wherever. But I do think it's very important that as we talk about continuing to do strategic initiatives and continue to engage in this business of reforming our education system and trying to do things differently to result with better outcomes, that we actually are able to have the input of those people who are actually at the ground level. It could be parents, they could be, you know, community members, they could be from all walks of life, but to be able to have them to be involved in those discussions as they are happening. So that's the intent. It's a minor tweak. It just adds one more member to the OEIB, and that's what we would love to see happen. So I'll be happy to share more with you when we get to that time in just a few short weeks from now. So
thank you. Any questions? Just picking up the wire. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Representative Comp. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Oh,
thank you.
Welcome.
Yes, Chair Gelser, committee members, thank you for this opportunity. For the record, my name is Betty Comp, and I represent House District 22, Woodburn, Jervis, in North Salem. Before you is LC 233, and I introduced it to make an important adjustment to the legislation that was passed last year. House Bill 3233 was passed and it included expanding the use of school district collaboration funds to allow school districts to apply for the design grants in addition to the implementation grants. No limits were placed on the amount of design grants. The bill I'm introducing would allow only one design grant and limit the grant period to 12 months. The purpose of that is if you do a design grant, you shouldn't have to do it a second time. So there's no need for a multiple design grant. And then multiple design grants strip limitations of funds from other districts that haven't had that opportunity yet. And then finally, open-ended grant periods do not support the transitions that we're needing to get, reach our 40-40-20 goal by 2025. It rather hinders the process rather than enhances it. Currently, in communication with the Department of Education, they agree with this conceptually in this direction, and if they take administrative action rulemaking to put this in the rules, then we will not need this bill.
So, and when will we know that?
I don't have that information. It's real, obviously, very soon. But any questions about that? It's kind of like when you're an architect, you draw the plans right, hopefully the first time, and you do such a good job, you don't have to redesign it. So,
great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Gelser and committee.
I don't see any other members in the room that want to talk about their bills, except for the spirit of Representative Buckley, who's coming at 3:45. So,
and he's not in his office.
We will be at ease until 3:45.
and you will all be out by 4.
Excellent.
So thank you. You can all go to your final destination of the day.
Oh, I was going to say. Wait a minute. That doesn't sound right.
Where are these?
Okay. I'm going to be driving home and see the Grim Reaper.
You're still wearing
your kind of professorial sort of look. Yeah.
Yep, yep. Sounds good, Peter. No questions.
All right.
Legislation.
Welcome back. We are back on the record. Representative Buckley, you are the last presentation before the special reception.
Wow.
Madam Chair,
Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County and Legislature, thank you so much for your indulgence. My apologies for keeping you waiting. And I appreciate your consideration of the proposal that we're bringing forward today. It is basically what you have now right now is a placeholder. This is a great, it's not a great story, but it's an interesting story.
is it a short story?
It's a very short story. House Bill 2220 in 2011, the intent was very simple. And if you read the text of the bill, it still seems simple to me. The intent was to set some standards for proficiency for the main subjects in the curriculum and allow for districts, if a district should choose, to also look at proficiency gradings, how they would grade different other areas of the curriculum if they chose to move towards a proficiency-based system. There is nothing in the bill that was discussed in any committee, nothing in the bill that I could see in writing that said that a district had to move to proficiency-based for all subject areas, that a district could not include extra credit, a district could not include behavior. There was nothing in the bill that said that.
What about homework?
Nothing in the bill that talked about homework. The bill was very simple. It was, I think, a page and a half bill. It was a pretty darn simple bill that simply said, you know, some of our districts are moving towards proficiency-based education. Some of them are getting really good results. We should have at least a process of defining how they're grading in proficiency-based education for science and math and English. We should have that standard so people understand it. And then here's the format if you want to go forward. The idea was to be totally voluntary for our school districts, and as you know, it didn't end up that way. It ended up being translated into what many districts saw as a mandate to jump through incredible hurdles to try to all shift to a proficiency-based system. That system works well for some students. It works well for some districts. It doesn't work well for everything. It was never intended to be a one-size-fits-all. However, that's how it ended up. So there was a great deal of interest in coming forward to this session and saying, hey, let's see if we can clarify that. In our attempt to clarify it, we got the draft back on Monday, and we sent it around. And the questions on our attempt to clarify it have become so complex that we simply have to pull back and kind of go, okay, we're obviously not there. We don't have a simplification. If it's taken us so long to explain our simplification, we got to pull back. So my request to this committee, Madam Chair, with your indulgence, is for you to be alerted that there will be a proposal in front of you to simplify House Bill 2020 from the 2011 session. We will get the text to you, the revised text to you, ASAP for your consideration. We look forward to input you have on the simplification, so make sure your school districts are absolutely clear that it's not a mandate. In fact, what we sent to the Ledge Council, we actually had language in. The one section says, nothing in this bill is to be considered a mandate on school districts. It was written in really large language, but we can't seem to get that across in statute. I'm not sure if you put that in statute or not. So with that, Madam Chair, I appreciate your time and particularly your patience on this. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I've been working with the Oregon Education Association to bring forward this bill, and Lori Wimmer is here from OEA as well. And she'd be, I'm sure I'm speaking for her. She would be happy, I'm sure, to answer questions as well on the approach that we're taking and try to make it an inclusive approach. The main thing we're trying to do is the districts that have already gone down the road on this, God bless them, tell them that they're fine. The districts who are still in the process to see if we can make it as inclusive as possible so that that we make sure teachers are part of this conversation on what proficiency should be listed at in their districts. And to, again, make it clear, this is not a mandate on districts to everyone switch to proficiency-based education. Yes, you can include homework. Yes, you can include behavior. Yes, you can include whatever your district feels is the right thing for your district and your students. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Buckley. Any questions, Representative Gorsuch?
So this is to undo an unfunded mandate that we didn't make?
Madam Chair, that's absolutely correct.
So, Representative Gorsuch, the first indication that I had that this was a problem was probably last February or March, and in my capacity as a parent of some high school kids, I was sitting in the monthly meeting with the principal, and he was talking about these changes to grading based on some legislation. He was talking about homework, and I thought, I don't remember a bill in which we banned homework. And if we had one, I'm pretty sure it would have come to our committee. So I look it up. I've got my iPhone. I'm like, what is this bill? And it pops up, and it says Buckley-Gelser.
And you did it in your sleep.
And that's, my children keep telling me that I ruined their lives. And I tell them I didn't mean to.
Madam Chair, if I just comment, when the chair of your committee came to me with these concerns, I laughed. I thought she was kidding. I said, that can't possibly be so. The bill is so simple. I thought she misinterpreted what had been said, but unfortunately you had not.
So basically this bill, as interpreted, is what every kid running for like student body president promises, the bill banning homework?
Well, but what the kids have learned is they don't want homework banned because what the implementation has been and what the experience has been is if you go into your math class or your science class and now your grade is 90% based on the test that you take, right, and you can't, and you're a bad test taker, your homework, your effort, the other ways that you're demonstrating the way that you perform in the class aren't counting. And of course, districts have always had the ability to make that choice on their own. Districts can choose how to do the grading. The point is, the legislature did not. And in fact, the law itself, the statute, there's nothing in the statute that requires this, which is what makes the fix complicated because we're fixing something that doesn't exist in the statute. But clearly, there needs to be some clarification because people believe, based on some miscommunication in the interim, that there is something in statute that bans homework. And
okay. Could you restate for me what this bill would do if it really were implemented correctly? Because now I thought I understood it.
Madam Chair,
is proficiency tested on
what it would do? It asks districts to define what proficiency is.
It allows them to.
For the three main subjects of math, science, and reading.
Allows or requires.
They would require districts to at least identify what proficiency means. Okay. It doesn't say how to identify. It just says for your district, for those established areas, identify it so that parents, students can know, is my student proficient in this subject area or not? And then it would allow, if districts wanted to continue down that road and also do the same thing for health class, for music, for any other subject, they could definitely do it. But the bill required them to do it for those three main subjects. So just so students and teachers and parents could understand what was being used to judge proficiency. It was seen as a tool to help districts that were already moving in the direction of proficiency-based education, to help move them down that road and formalize, in a sense, proficiency-based education for their district. There's been some great results. I believe the Redmond School District, I know that Springfield got the proficiency-based project. Ashland School District has.
I just needed a clarification on what was allowed and what was required. So
charter school does it.
Thank you.
Any other questions, comments, suggestions. And for those who are thinking, this is not a bill that we did in 2013. This was in
2011.
Before I was here. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
What I said.
You bleep that out.
It is 5 minutes till four.
Oh, excellent. Four minutes.
You're so precise.
Radio guy.
Yeah. You're proficient in time telling.
You 104 the Dalles.
We're adjourned. Thank you. We're adjourned. Thank you.
You 104 the Dalles.